Danny Cox, a former jet pilot turned business leader, in his book, Seize the Day, wrote that when jet fighters were first invented, they flew much faster than their propeller predecessors. So pilot ejection became a more sophisticated process. Theoretically, of course, all a pilot needed to do was push a button, clear the plane, then roll forward out of the seat so the parachute would open. But there was a problem that popped up during the testing. Some pilots, instead of letting go, would keep a grip on the seat. The parachute would remain trapped between the seat and the pilot's back. The engineers went back to the drawing board and came up with a solution. And Cox writes it this way. He said, the new design called for a 2-inch webbed strap, one end attached to the front edge of the seat under the pilot, and the other end attached to an electronic take-up reel behind the headrest. 2 seconds after ejection, the electronic take-up reel would immediately take up the slack and force the pilot forward out of his seat, thus freeing the parachute. Pilots needed the device to launch them out of their chairs. The question for each one of us, and particularly during tough times, what will launch us out of our chairs to do what needs to be done during tough times? In Nehemiah chapter 2, beginning with verse 11, it reads, so I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I told no one what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem, nor were there any animal with me except the one on which I rode. And I went out by night through the valley gate to the serpent well and the refuse gate, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem that were broken down, and its gates which were burned with fire. And then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no room there for the animal under me to pass. So I went up in the night by the valley and viewed the wall. Then I turned back and entered by the valley gate and so returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done. I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the others who did the work. Then I said to them, you see the distress that we're in, how Jerusalem lies waste and its gates are burned with fire. Come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer be a reproach. And I told them, the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and also of the king's words that he had spoken to me. So they said, let us rise and build. They set their hands to this good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they laughed at us and despised us and said, what is this thing that you are doing? Will you rebel against the king? And so I answered him and said to them, the God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore, we his servants will arise and build, but you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem. From this passage, I'd like us to consider 4 priorities for responding to the circumstances of tough times. First of all, assess the situation. If you're going to thrive in tough times, you must look honestly at your situation. A financial planner will help a person by exploring every expense, every debt, and every source of income. A career coach will review where a client is before recommending a career change. A relationship counselor will make an accurate assessment of problems before improvement advice can be made. A company held an inter-office softball game every year between the marketing and the support staff. It's one game every year. Usually, the marketing department won the game. But 1 year, the support staff beat them badly. The marketing department took a lot of heat for losing the annual game. In response, someone in the marketing department decided to spin the results and published a news report on the company's bulletin board. And it read, The marketing department is pleased to announce that we earned second place in the recent softball season after losing only one game all year. The support department, however, had a rough season winning only one game. You got to take a good look and you got to assess the situation, whether it's in softball or something more important than a softball game. An assessment of things is crucial. In verse 17, records Nehemiah, I said to them, you see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lies waste and its gates are burned with fire. And then once you've assessed the situation, you need to make the plan. What was Nehemiah's plan? We looked at that the last time. We need to wait, need to pray. You need to start where you are, and then you need to seize the moment. Then at the appropriate time, you have to present the plan to those who will be involved with you. In the second part of that, verse 17, and down into verse 18, it says, come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem, that we may no longer be a reproach. And I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and also of the king's words that he had spoken to me. And so they said, let us rise up and build. And then they set their hands to this good work. In the King James Version, Proverbs chapter 29 and verse 18 reads differently than most of the other translation. It's probably the best rendering of that verse. Where there's no vision, the people perish. There needs to be a plan. Walt Disney had a plan to build an amusement park, and his plan resulted in Disneyland in California. And then he planned Disney World just outside of Orlando, Florida. Today, that amusement park in Orlando occupies 47 square miles, an area about the size of San Francisco, California. By the time the park opened, Walt Disney had died. His wife was asked to speak at the grand opening. She was introduced by a man who said, Mrs. Disney, I just wish that Walt could have seen this. Mrs. Disney stood up and said, he did. And then she sat down. Her speech was over. Through his plan, Walt Disney had already enjoyed Disney World. Assess the situation, then make the plan, then you got to support the effort. Alex Haley wrote, if you see a turtle on top of a fence post, you know that he didn't get there by himself. Carrying out a plan usually involves other people, helpers. And carrying out a plan usually encounters difficulties. If you're going to get to the top of your fence post with the help of others, then there'll need to be a lot of encouragement. And Nehemiah was no different. Verse 19, it says, but when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they laughed at us and despised us and said, what is this thing that you're doing? Will you rebel against the king? In tough times, the last thing you need is discouragement. The fear factor was introduced into that whole situation by the enemies of the rebuilding. What did they say? Will you rebel against the king? Oh my goodness, we're doing something that the king wouldn't want us to do? We're rebelling against his authority? So Nehemiah stepped right up to the plate in verse 20. And he said, I answered them and said to them, the God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore, we his servants will arise and build, but you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem. What we're doing, God has called us to do, we're going to do it. He's going to give us the help. He's going to make us prosper. He's going to give us success, but you have no part of this. You're not part of what God is doing here, and you need to understand that. Encouragement is necessary if we're going to thrive in life, especially in the midst of tough times. We need encouragement. A young man in London wanted to be a writer, but the cards just seemed to be against him. He had only 4 years of school, and his father was in jail because he couldn't pay his debts. Just to survive the pain of hunger, he got a job pasting labels on bottles in a rat-infested warehouse. He slept in an attic with two other boys from the slums. With such little confidence in himself and his ability to write, he secretly slipped out and mailed his first manuscript in the middle of the night so no one would laugh at his dream. That manuscript, along with countless others, was rejected. Finally, one story was accepted. He wasn't paid anything, but the editor praised him for his writing. That one little compliment caused him to wander aimlessly through the streets with tears rolling down his cheeks. It inspired him to continue to improve and led to the brilliant writing career of Charles Dickens. That little bit of encouragement, what a difference it made. And then finally, number four, you got to stay the course. Under Nehemiah's leadership, the people began a 52-day project that proved to be harder than any of them had anticipated. They were the leanest of lean times there in Jerusalem. And they weren't raising food for their families while they were working there. They weren't taking care of their bills while they were working there. They weren't getting anything done at home because of the rebuilding project that they were doing at the wall of Jerusalem. And so they got very discouraged. They got discouraged, but Nehemiah kept them on course. One by one, each gate was up and finished. Block by block, each stone was backed in place on the wall. And they stayed the course because Nehemiah encouraged them to stay the course. And that got the job done. Max Lucado, he tells the story of the most sacred symbol in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. It's a tree. A sprawling, shade-bearing, 80-year-old American elm. Tourists drive from miles around to see her. People pose for pictures beneath her. Arborists carefully protect her. She adorns posters and letterhead. Other trees grow larger, fuller, even greener, but not one is equally cherished. The city treasures the tree not because of her appearance, but her endurance. She endured the Oklahoma City bombing. Timothy McVeigh parked his death-laden truck only yards from her. His malice killed 168 people, wounded 850, destroyed the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building, and buried that tree in rubble. No one expected it to survive. No one gave any thought to the dusty, branch-stripped tree. But then she began to bud. Sprouts pressed through damaged bark, green leaves pushed away gray soot, life resurrected from an acre of death. The tree modeled the resilience the victims desired, so they gave the elm tree a name. It's known as the survivor tree. When Nehemiah challenged the people to rebuild the walls, they said, "Let us rise up and build." And then they set their hands to this good work. And how did they work? Well, they lifted huge timbers and massive stones. They used chisels and saws and hammers and pulleys. They worked to lift heavy stones. They worked from morning until night. They also carried their weapons with them at the same time. Everywhere they went, prepared to fight against the enemies. They worked with a trowel in one hand and a sword in the other. If God calls you to accomplish a heroic task, then he expects you to work like a hero to do it. Just consider the heroes of God's work. Noah, he had to build an ark, and it took many, many years to accomplish it. Over 100 years it took him to build that ark. Moses had to deal with stress levels that would have killed most men as God's delivering leader. Abraham had to walk across entire nations encouraged only by a dream, a promise of a future blessing. David had to battle as a warrior and struggle daily for years before arriving at the throne room of Israel in Jerusalem. Jesus himself had to labor in Joseph's carpentry shop until he was 30 years old as he prepared for his earthly ministry and the redemptive work on the cross of Calvary. Nehemiah is a book that is absolutely drenched with the sweat of hard work. When you dare to ask God to give you a dream, you better be prepared to work hard, extremely hard. This may seem like a kind of a strange way to end this message, but, well, here goes. One evening, while a man was driving down a country road, he lost control of his car and he wound up in a ditch. He walked to the closest farmhouse and he asked for help pulling the car out. And the farmer said, "Sure, let me hitch up Dusty and you'll be out in no time." And a few minutes later, the farmer appeared with Dusty, an old, swayed-back, almost blind mule. After Dusty was hitched up to the car, the old farmer cracked the whip and said, "Pull, Buck, pull!" But nothing happened. And the stranger looked around for a mule named Buck. There weren't any other mules. There was only Dusty, who wasn't moving. So the farmer cracked the whip again, and he said, "Pull, Clyde, pull!" Stranger took another look, but there was still only one mule hitched to his car, and that mule's name wasn't Clyde. Nothing had happened. So the farmer cracked the whip again and said, "Pull, Dusty, pull!" And Dusty began to pull until finally the car was out of the ditch. The man thanked the farmer and he said, "You know, I'm really curious. If your mule's name is Dusty, why did you say pull Buck and pull Clyde? That doesn't make any sense." The farmer said, "Well, you know, Dusty's old, and he doesn't see too good, and he doesn't have much confidence. Why, if he thought he were here to do all the work himself, he'd never even try." Listen, you don't have to handle tough times by yourself either. The same God who helped Nehemiah and who helped Ezra is ready to help you as well in the midst of your tough times. You simply need to ask.